God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen. Simple Actions Group wishes to extend a warm welcome to all in attendance today. These premises are non-smoking. Our group is welcome to use this room and the restrooms exclusively. Is there anyone in the room tonight in their first 30 days of sobriety? We would just like to welcome you by first name. Nobody's going to interview you. You could just let us know who you are. Anybody in their first 30 days tonight? Mary, welcome. Anybody else? I'm feeling like three more. I don't blame you. At this time, please silence your cell phones. Also, we respectfully ask that those present please refrain from unnecessary moving around the room. This will keep distractions and disturbances to a minimum and allow everyone to listen uninterrupted. The foreword of the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. We of Alcoholics Anonymous are more than 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. To show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. For them, we hope these pages will prove so convincing that no further authentication will be necessary. We think this account of our experiences will help everyone to better understand the alcoholic. Many do not comprehend that the alcoholic is a very sick person. And besides, we're sure that our way of living has its advantages for all. It is the purpose of this meeting to carry that clear message and focus on precisely how to recover from the illness of alcoholism by taking AA's simple actions. So normally the format of this meeting is a it's sort of an ongoing workshop on the 12 steps. We have paragraphs out of the big book. If you come back next week, we'll be on step one, part one, and a home group member will chair the meeting, and then we'll have two people come in, share their experience, strength, and hope on step one. Come back the week after that, step two, et cetera. And then, so it takes us about 13 weeks to go through the 12 steps. And then on that 14th week, we have a supper and a speaker, which is where we all are now. Now that we're all oriented in time and space. Very excited to hear Connie's story tonight. She's highly recommended. She and her husband have driven all the way down from Richmond. And I don't want to take up another moment of her time. I give you Connie V.
Thank you. How much time do I have? 4 minutes.
Okay.
There's a lot of y'all here. Hey there, I'm Connie. I am an alcoholic.
This is a really intimidating microphone, too. Okay.
Try to look over it and past it. Thank you for having me. True story, I honestly thought maybe you were not going to invite me. David called me a couple months ago to invite me. And, you know, as we all have a lot of numbers in our phone that are not saved with people's names, because we meet people and they call us. And I looked at the phone and it was a 757 area code. And I thought, okay, I don't know who this is, but I should answer it. And I did. And this booming voice is like, hi, this is David, how are you? And I'm like, fine. Who are not very nice at all. It was not my best moment. And he said, David from Simple Solutions, which sounds kind of like a home renovation sort of something. It wasn't mathing in my head. And then he said, like, a group in Norfolk. And all of a sudden, I was like, oh my God, I can't believe I was so rude. So we hung up the phone. I thought, well, I guess that won't be happening. So it is, though. And here I am. And thank you for having me. So my sobriety date is September 19th, 2012. I am from Richmond, Virginia. Although about a year and a half ago, my husband and I moved about 30 miles north, so I'm actually in Hanover, Virginia now. I have a home group there. It's called the Hanover Ashland Group, and we meet in Ashland on Monday nights and Thursday nights at 7:30 if you're ever in the area. And there's also a noon meeting on Wednesdays, but I can't ever make that one because I work full-time. But that is my new home group. I do have a sponsor. And I do have the pleasure of sponsoring other women in this program. So there's all those particulars. So experience, strength, and hope. And thank you for praying with me before we got my favorite prayer, the third step prayer, and my next favorite prayer, which is just God help. And I need help. And the reason why I need help is that I stand up here, and there are a lot of y'all here tonight, and it's been a minute since I've been in front of this many people. The meetings in our new hometown are much, much smaller, like 10, 15 people maybe on a good night. So it's been a while, and I do get nervous, and I am still sometimes consumed with self and want to make sure that I share a message of experience, strength, and hope. And I also want you to like me and think I'm really smart. So if I get all that out of the way and I get honest, maybe I can share something with some, depth and weight. So I am born and raised in Richmond. I come from an upper middle class Jewish family, and I mention that because it becomes relevant as I share more of my story. I'm the youngest of four girls. My three older sisters are not alcoholic. I had mom and dad and my grandmother. We all lived under one roof, not an alcoholic in sight. So I don't know how well I was so lucky to get that, but it's just me. And so growing up in Richmond in the 1960s in this very normal family, and we sort of lived in this area of Richmond. Again, think about it. It's the 1960s, and it's a little segregated. And we're in this sort of little group of houses on one side of the street because the area across the street, which was beautiful, did not allow people like us. And so we all lived on this one side of the street. But I didn't understand any of that when I was that age. And we went walked to the neighborhood elementary school, and everything was fine. And it's funny because when I did my fourth step, it honestly went all the way back to kindergarten, which was embarrassing, really, but it's the truth. Growing up, going to kindergarten, and it was public school down the street, and it was the first time that I was exposed to kids that were not from the same group like my family was. And all of a sudden, I felt very out of place. I was one of those kids that cried every day at school. And I couldn't tell you why. I just felt this kind of anxiety in me, and I didn't have the words to explain what it was. But it just felt like even then, at the age of 6 years old, like there was this sort of glass bubble between me and the rest of the world. And I felt that. And the school, they'd send me to the nurse's office, and they'd take my temperature, and they'd say she's fine, and they'd call my mother, and she had to come pick me up. And my mom would say things to me like, "What's wrong with you?" Like you can say that to a 6-year-old. The other thing that I remember a lot about that age, I have this crazy curly hair. My sisters don't have this hair. When I was that little, my hair was about as red as the cups on the table. I didn't look anything like my family. And what would happen is I'd be out with my family, and very well-intentioned people, usually older people, would come up and say things like, "Oh, are you from the mailman?" Something like that. And they thought, and you laugh and you think it's being funny, but when you're 6 years old and all you want to do is feel like you're part of a family, so I just constantly felt like I was being separated and I was different. I was also a real tomboy. And also, my mom did not know what to do with all my curls. And so she cut them all off. So I looked like a boy, which was not a thing back in 1969. As I'm growing into adolescence, I'm just feeling more and more awkward and uncomfortable. And I'm a tomboy, and my sisters are not like that. They wear dresses. I don't want to wear dresses. And then something very strange happened in the city of Richmond with the school system. And they started rearranging where all the kids were going to go to school. And my parents got scared, and they very promptly put me in private school. And they had this really inspired idea to send me to the local Jewish private school. And when I say that, I mean it was like Orthodox Jewish, and I grew up Jewish light, okay? Like just And they didn't know much about it, and they really were all academics. My family is all they're all academics. My parents were Phi Beta Kappa. My father was a professor at the local university. It was all about education, and that was really all they were concerned about. And so they sent me to the school. So now all of a sudden, again, I am feeling weird and out of place because I am not like these kids either. And there were seven kids in my class, tiny little class. And for several years, I was also the only girl in that class. So, you're 11, 12, 13 years old, and you're in a classroom with, four or five other boys that would tease me relentlessly. And I got a lot of teasing because I wasn't like them. I went from being, the only Jewish kid in the classroom to now being in a classroom where they told me that I wasn't Jewish at all because I didn't go to the right synagogue. And so it's weird. And my parents left me there for 7 years. And I agree, I probably did get a really good education. Half the day was English secular studies, and half the day was Hebrew. And I'm talking men with beards and black coats. And I mean, just completely foreign to me, just totally foreign. And then getting ready for 8th grade, my parents had another inspired idea to send me to a different private school. And this time they sent me to an Episcopalian high school. So it just, from one extreme to the other. So now I'm in this school, and again, I'm the odd kid out, and it's just, it was just the perfect storm of insecurity and self-centered fear. And I didn't understand what that was or where that was coming from. I just knew that I felt so apart from. And then, I did have friends. I mean, I had one or two friends, and honestly, to this day, I'm still like that. I'm kind of an introvert, and I have a very tight circle. I'm just not like that. And I had a couple of good friends, and we spent a lot of time playing in the neighborhood. I like to, like I said, do sports and play in the dirt and ride bikes and do that kind of thing. And then I guess I want to say probably at about the age, oh, how old I was? I was 14. When I was 14, my father was diagnosed with cancer. And that consumed our whole lives. And again, that it's not normal. That's not like a normal thing. It's not an unusual thing, but it's not a normal thing. So now I'm that kid. I'm that kid with the sick parent. And my three older sisters at that point in time had moved on out of the house. They're a lot older than I am. And it left me in the house with my mother and my grandmother, which was kind of uncomfortable. And my dad was sick for about a year, and then he passed away right after I turned 15. So, and then what happened was, after being raised in this family with these kind of helicopter sort of parents that were all up in my business and a lot of rules and responsibilities and expectations in my family, again, it was all about education and money and marry the right person. And there was a lot of attention on what we were doing and where we were going. And then all of a sudden, my father passed away and my mom just let go. And I thought that was great. And I turned 16, and she tossed me the keys to the car because she went off to go find herself. And I, at this when I think about it now, she was younger than I am now, and so when I look at my life and think that probably was pretty difficult. And again, this is something I didn't discover until I did my fourth step, how that might have felt. But she did. She turned me loose, and I took full advantage of that. And all of a sudden, I'm the kid who's not particularly supervised, and I have a car at my disposal. And on top of that, turning 15 and 16, adolescence was kind to me after going through those awkward years of being skinny, flat-chested, short red hair. My hair grew out into these beautiful long locks, which, by the way, I straightened. I did not wear them curly. And I discovered boys. And things, life got really fun. And there was the crowd that I hung out with. They partied a lot. Honestly, it wasn't a whole lot of drinking back then. It weird, but it was easier to get a hold of other substances at that time than it was to get a hold of alcohol. Although I did have an older sister who was helpful when she was in town, with that. But otherwise, it was a lot of other substances. In high school, the last few years was just a ton of fun. I had a great time. And I think about it when I read Bill's story and it talks about, I have arrived. It's kind of how I felt. I went from being this awkward, geeky, sort of uncomfortable kid to all of a sudden this kid that really was having a good time. And then it came time to go off to college. And like I said, in my family, we were raised with this expectation. Education was number one. There were diplomas all over the wall of the house that I grew up in from my parents. Money, marry the right person. Those were the keys to success. If you could achieve those things, you were guaranteed success in life. And so I went off to college. I was not an academically inclined kid. I went to the school that two of my sisters went to because it was an easy decision. It was also in Washington, D.C., which sounded like a lot of fun. And I picked a major that I really didn't care about, but it sounded interesting and maybe would get me through 4 years. And so I went up to school and I promptly became a little sister for a fraternity. So I'm not going to be in a sorority because I don't want to play by your rules and I don't want to have to show up and do things your way, but I will gladly come to your party and drink your beer and smoke your pot. And so that's what I did. I was a little sister for this fraternity and it was a lot of fun. And there were a lot of boys and life was great. And when I think about it, it never occurred to me what I was doing, that I was arranging my life around, partying and these things, but I was. And in the 4 years that I was in school, I only had classes on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. I arranged it for 4 years that I never had a Friday class. And that was so that my weekend could start on Thursday. And that was very important to me, and there were times I would have this recurring dream, even not all that long ago, where I would, be trying to get to class and couldn't remember what building the class was in. And I thought that was unique to me. And then I saw a meme about it a couple weeks ago. And apparently a lot of people have that dream, only that was the truth for me. And then I also remember one time showing up to class and discovering that we had an exam. And like a good alcoholic, I got up and walked out. I was like, I'll deal with that problem later. So that's what school looked like. I did manage to graduate. I did flunk one class. I flunked modern Jewish history, of all things. So I don't know. Explain that. So I had to, much to my mother's dismay, she was horrified that a daughter of hers failed a class. I mean, again, it was all about education, money, marry the right person. And this whole time I'd been dating this kid all through high school and through college. And he was not any of those things. He was not the right religion. He had dropped out of school and I think he was dealing drugs. And his family, though, was pretty well off, but he did not meet the specifications. And I heard about that a lot. There were a lot of conversations about that and the fact that it was a disappointment who I was seeing. And so when I graduated from school and I moved back to Richmond, and I cannot explain what happened, but I had sort of this revelation that it was sort of time. It was time to put all that other stuff aside, follow the family formula, education, check mark, I'd done that, money, I need to go get a job, start a career, marry the right person, And so I could not have told you this is what I was doing at the time. It's only in hindsight that I see it, but that's exactly what I did. And I went out and I found the person who checked all the boxes. Nice Jewish boy. And I married this man and I put down all the substances. And it wasn't like I put him down like white knuckle, put him down. It left. And I looked back on what my, high school and college years had been like, and I really just chalked it up to just kid behavior. It really didn't seem to be anything that unusual. And I had surrounded myself with a lot of kids that were doing the same thing anyway, and a lot of them looked a lot worse than I had. And I had graduated, and so there you go. And so I met this man and we got married and immediately started assembling the pieces of life that I was told that I was supposed to have in order to be happy. And we went out and we bought the house and we started having babies. I had three children in 4 years. I worked full time when my kids were small, which I did not want to do at all. But he told me that we had to. It made no sense because honestly, we could have afforded for it to be different. But he told me I would be boring if I just stayed home with the kids.
So I worked full time and I have these three kids and life is crazy and he is completely absent. He's doing his own thing, he has his own business and he's never around. And I used to say I was probably the closest thing to a single parent for a married woman. And again, you know, I've also, by the way, gone to a few Al-Anon meetings. You know, I didn't see all that then. I didn't understand it. And because I am an achiever, and because I am told that if you assemble the parts and pieces, that your life is guaranteed to be a success. And I had assembled the pieces, and damn it all, I was going to make my life a success. And things just got busy and chaotic and crazy and working full time and running kids around. And what happened, and this, it really, really snuck up on me. It never occurred to me when I started drinking again what I was getting ready to unleash. It started really innocently. 10 o'clock at night, I'm at home alone with three kids. I've successfully gotten them home from school. I've worked a full day. I've gotten them to soccer practice. I've fed them. We've done homework. I get them into bed. And now it's time to, I'm gonna clean up the kitchen, do laundry. And the thought occurred to me, I could use a drink. And it was as simple as that. And I justified it with a lot of women do that. What is the harm in that? And it started with, you know, box of wine in the refrigerator. And just like, you know, one drink at night while I was taking care of the house, stuff at the house. So, in all kinds of rules. Like, I'm never going to drink in front of the kids. You know, I'm never going to drink and drive. Oh my God, I would never do that. You know, I'm never going to be drunk in front of the kids. And then, as we all know, this is a progressive disease. It gets worse and it happens sort of imperceptibly where 10 o'clock and one glass of wine became 9 o'clock and two glasses of wine became 8 o'clock. And then, you know, the wine's not really cutting it. I think maybe I'll switch to vodka. And you know, within a couple of years, I'm that mom. I'm that mom driving around the county in a gigantic SUV with a car full of kids, mine and other people's, and I'm drunk off of my ass, you know, and what my life, and but also by that time, I had quit working. I had discovered in the interim that my husband had been having an affair. And I told him when I found out, I'm like, well, guess what? I'm never working another day in my life. That's your punishment. And no, I'm not leaving. And so that's what life will look like. Well, you know, there's nothing better for a good alcoholic mom than to be a stay-at-home mom. And what that began to look like was rolling out of bed at 6 o'clock in the morning and shuffling the kids off to school and getting him out of the house. And then I could drink the way that I wanted to drink. And I would do that until about 1 or 2 o'clock in the afternoon. I'd set an alarm so that I could get up and take a shower and throw in a couple loads of laundry, and the kids would get home, and it would look like mom had been doing stuff. And then it was like, let's load everybody in the car and head out to soccer practice. And this is like in the days of the Garmin GPSs. And if you looked at it, it was nothing but this circuitous route around Chesterfield County, Virginia, of soccer fields and ABC stores. Because I would only drink the little airplane bottles when I was out and about. I kept the big handle in the, I had actually three or four of them kind of scattered around the house so that nobody would find them in the closet, in the garage, in the kitchen, laundry room. And I would just sort of mark go around the house all night long, taking swigs off of it. But when I was out and about, it was all about the little bottles, and you need to replenish those. And you can't go to the same ABC store more than once a week because the staff gets to know you. And why that mattered to me, I don't know, but it did. And so I had my little route. And, you know, I cannot. I'm not a blackout drunk. I don't understand why, because the quantity that I drank certainly sort of qualified me to be that, but I never had a blackout. I never got a DUI, and that's only because I never got caught. I was what someone would consider high functioning alcoholic, you know. I had it all together. I had an absolute death grip on life.
Everything was regimented. The time we got up, when I did the laundry, when you went to soccer practice. And if anybody moved out of line, it was like the sky was going to fall. Just absolute screaming chaos. And my kids will tell me about it now, you know, that they remember that. And I'm not proud of that. I was a screamer, yelling. And I really felt like the world was going to end. Everything was going to collapse. It was like, you know, that game of Tetris and the little pieces are falling and you're trying to flip them. And the first few lines go great. You know, you make a whole line and it jump. And then that one piece turns the wrong way. And all of a sudden they're all piling up and the whole thing explodes. And that's what life felt like. Just absolute. And I am drinking now, you know, around the clock, and it's ugly. And everything on the outside was beautiful, though. We had this big, beautiful home. We lived on 50 acres. We had horses. My daughter was a competitive equestrian. My boys were playing travel soccer. I'm driving a big SUV. I mean, it looked grand on the outside, and the inside was just sick. And simultaneously, my husband had developed a dependency on prescription opioids. I knew nothing. I didn't understand it. I knew he took them. I didn't have any experience with that growing up. I never knew anybody who was an addict. And they were prescribed by a doctor, right? So, like, must be okay. You know, so the two of us, we're getting sicker and sicker. And then he tells me that I need to go back to work, and because we need health insurance. And I hadn't worked in, I don't know, 10 years. And I thought, oh my God, how am I going to work when I drink all day? Like, how is that gonna work? And I was able actually to get a position. I reached out to some people that I had worked with 10 years previous. I had actually established a whole career in healthcare administration, and got a job like in a week. I could not believe it. And I got the dream job and I was so excited. And I went back to work, and our marriage, by the way, is it's just fallen apart. And so getting that job really turned out to be a God thing in a lot of ways. And I was like, I can't drink on the job. I can't, you know. And so that lasted about 8 months of not drinking on the job. And I would wait until I got off work and got home, and I would drink. And then what happens? Because this is a progressive, incurable disease that we all know. I couldn't wait until I got home. And so I started drinking in the car, in the parking lot after work on my way home. And I'm sure that the highway to this day is probably littered with little teeny airplane bottles that I was throwing out the window all the way home. But then I couldn't wait till 5, and then it was 4. And then I started noticing about 10 o'clock in the morning that I'm sweating profusely and I'm shaking. What is that? I'm detoxing by 10 o'clock in the morning. Okay. And I don't understand anything about any of this. So now I'm drinking at 10 o'clock in the morning. And I switched from drinking, my drink of choice at that point was tequila. I switched to peppermint schnapps during the day because one, it's like 110 proof. And two, it smells like mint. So people will just think it's mouthwash. And so I'm the queen of maintenance level drinking. I know just enough that I need to drink that it will make that shaking and sweating go away and make me feel okay. And that's what I did. But it got worse. And what was starting to happen, I got to check the time because I have to remember to get sober. And so I'm starting to overshoot the mark. Because now I'm drinking at 6 o'clock in the morning with my coffee before I even leave for the office. And that one or two shots in the morning, a couple times I actually hit like three or four. And I'm driving on the interstate and I'm thinking, oh, th this, I went past the maintenance level. I now have gone into, I feel drunk territory, which for any like non-alcoholic, God knows what my blood alcohol was. I was probably hammered. But y'all know that we have an amazing ability to not be like that. And I was starting to get scared. I was scared that I was going to get discovered at work. And this is probably one time when ego really served me well. You know, we're told that in this program, egos, that's, you know, that's a bad thing. In this case, the fear of getting found out was probably a really good thing. I did not want to lose my job. I was this close to pulling the kids. Three of them were out of the house. The youngest one was 15. I was like, if I can just make it one more year until he's 16 and he can drive and I can get out of the house. And I wasn't going to make it. And I knew it. And I knew I was going to get busted. And so I walked into my boss's office one morning and just sat down and said, I need to talk to you. And I said, I got a problem. I can't stop drinking. And she's like, what are you talking about? You are never late for work. Your work is absolutely 100% perfect. And so I had to get like really graphic with her about what it looked like, drinking and vomiting in the ladies' room of the office. And she immediately, all of a sudden papers are coming out of her desk drawer and it's like sign here and sign there. And they got me set up with the employee assistance program, which required a couple of visits to like an addiction therapist. And so, sidebar, I'd been to therapy a few times over the years because mostly it was problems with my mother or my husband. That was the problem with my life. Of course, I never talked about drinking when I was in those therapy sessions, and I always showed up drunk. So, amazing that they didn't do a lot of good, but it became my continued employment became contingent on me at least doing six visits, and by some grace of God, I got in with this absolutely wonderful woman who knew what she was doing, and she worked hard on me. I don't know, for probably 3 or 4 months, and I'm still drinking. I'm showing up to her office drunk, and I'm thinking I'm pulling it off, and she doesn't know. It's so dumb, and she knew, and she just came saying, "Okay, you want to come back next week?" "Yes, I do." And she kept working hard on me, and you need to go to treatment. I can't go to treatment. I need this job. I can't lose my job. I got three kids. I can't do it. I can't do it. And she started talking to me about Tucker Pavilion. Y'all are familiar with the Richmond area. There's this hospital up there, and she's like, "You can go there and you can detox." And I said, "I'll think about it." And then you can go to AA. And I was like, oh no, I'm not going to AA. Because sidebar, I had also been to a handful of AA meetings about 4 years before. Some therapy that I was in, marriage counseling, I don't know, the topic of my drinking came up. And I was like, yeah, I'll go to some meetings. I'll get sober and you'll see that he's the problem, not me. And so I went to a handful of meetings and I thought you all were crazy Jesus freaks, honestly. And we're way too friendly. And also, y'all had really messed up. Like, you guys had DUIs. You guys had lost jobs. You guys had lost your kids. I hadn't, none of those things had happened to me, So I wasn't like you. Thank you very much. And I left. So this woman is working on me. These are they're God moments that I see in hindsight. I was not suicidal. But I was sort of getting to that point. In Bill's story, when it talks about him being in the house and he's afraid of jumping out a window, it's like this compulsion is going to take over you and you're just going to like do something. And so, like, he took the mattress down to the first floor or something. So, what was happening to me is I'd be driving down the road, not with the kids in the car, and I would have this weird compulsion that I would, what would happen if I just jerked the steering wheel? And it's weird. And I kind of got like afraid that I was going to maybe do something like that. And then, the other thing too was my own father had died when I was 15 and I turned out okay. So clearly my kids didn't need me. I mean, just the thinking. But then I'm looking at my husband, who by then had sold his business and had done nothing but lay in bed and pop pills for a year. And I'm looking at the two of us and I'm like, we're both dying. And one of us has got to do something, or my kids are going to end up being orphans. And I woke up one morning and I cannot explain what happened, but I woke up one morning and all of a sudden I didn't want to die. And I wanted to be there for my kids. And I looked at him and I said, I'm going to Tucker's. And he was like, hold on, wait a minute. What, maybe you should call somebody. And I was like, no, pack a suitcase. I was like, no, they will have toothbrushes and hospital gowns there. And I literally got in the car and drove myself to Tucker's. And then as soon as I got there, I thought I made a huge mistake. I just, the intake process was really lengthy. They kept coming back in the room and looking at me, and the same people kept coming in and asking me the same questions over and over again. I didn't understand. I was like, here's my therapist business card. Just call her. I'm like qualified to be here. I think that I heard later that if you show up there not drunk, that maybe that's a problem. And I had taken my last drink at like 11 o'clock the night before. So I don't know. It just took a really long time. And by the time they got me up to the floor, I'm starting to detox, you know, and everything. And I looked around at the people on the floor and I was like, oh, I'm in the wrong place. This will just be like mommy's vacation. I'll just lay back in the bed and watch TV and they'll bring me food. But that's not what it's like. There's no TVs in the rooms. And these people from AA show up. And on a Friday night that I was there, these two women came in from this home group in Richmond to bring an AA meeting. And I really didn't want to go to it, but there was nothing on TV and they won't give you snacks while the AA people are there. So I went and sat down and I listened to these two women from AA, and they were so much younger than me. And their story was completely different than mine. So I can't tell you what it was about it that registered with me, but something did. You know, I understood it was the feelings. It was that feeling of being separate from a part, that wall, that not getting the handbook in life, that whole thing I understood. And I understood from listening to them that they weren't like that anymore and that they had done it through Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I got discharged 2 days later. It was actually a Saturday. And I thought maybe I should go to an AA meeting, but technically I had done recovery that day because I woke up in Tucker's. So I didn't need to go to an AA meeting. So I decided that I would go on Sunday. And these two women, their home group met on Sunday. And they told me that they would be there. And I will say this to any home group member in any home group, if you ever tell a newcomer, I'll meet you at a meeting or I'll be at this meeting, you better be there. When I walked into that Sunday meeting, it was larger than this group here. I don't know, maybe half again as large. Big meeting, though. Scary meeting to walk into. And I looked around the room and those two women were there. And I made a beeline for those two women. And they did exactly what it is that we do here. You know, they gave me their phone numbers. They introduced me to other women in the program. Those women swarmed me, and everybody felt really, really friendly. But, you know, something told me that this is what you need to be doing. And I exchanged phone numbers with those people, and I went home, and I then very shortly thereafter separated from my husband, moved out into my own place. And both feet into AA. I got a home group, and after about 30 days of people nagging at me, I got a sponsor. Mostly because the home group, they had this habit of going around the room for every meeting, your name, sobriety date, and when you last talked to your sponsor. And I didn't want to be that person who said, I don't have a sponsor. And so I looked around the room and I picked the scariest woman that I could find. And I did that on purpose because I can be pretty confident, too confident for my own good, too smart for my own good. And I'm also very judgmental. And if I look at someone, especially another woman, sorry, and judge you for somehow being weak or less than, I'm not going to listen to a thing that you have to say. And I needed somebody who was kind of scary, and this woman was. In all the right ways. And, you know, so I asked her to be my sponsor, and she asked me three questions. Are you done yet? Are you willing to go to any lengths? And will you sponsor other women when you get through the 12 steps? And I answered yes to all three questions. I had absolutely no idea what I was agreeing to, but I wanted this woman to sponsor me. And so I said, yes. And we sat down and we started going through the book once a week, sitting in her living room, and she read to me, which I at first thought was just really insulting because I'm a college graduate. But she read to me, and we read through that big book, and we started literally on the very first page, like with the name Alcoholics Anonymous, like the whole forewords. We read everything cover to cover, and it took about a year for me to get through the 12 steps. And when we got done, and you know, she said, "Are you willing to sponsor other women?" And I said, "I am." And so, you know, I was involved in my home group. I think that's super important. To be involved in a home group, I had service positions. I got involved in district level service. Met a man in AA. Got remarried. My husband drove me here tonight. Thank you.
And life got really good really quickly. I probably had a good 2 years of that awesome pink cloud. And what I realized is that God kind of gave me a reprieve, waiting for me to get some sobriety under my belt, because after about the 2 year mark, like, oh my God, all things kind of went crazy. I finalized that divorce. It got really contentious and ugly. The man ended up committing suicide. My daughter gave birth to premature twins. They're called micro preemies. They were born at 25 weeks, spent 3 months in the NICU. We literally did not know from minute to minute whether they were going to live or not. It just, my mother died. It was just like the few years of just absolute insanity, probably from like 2014 to, I don't know, 2020. So, like, 6 years of just craziness. And the remarkable thing about it is that not in any one of those situations did I ever feel like I wanted to take a drink. I wanted relief for sure. And I found a relief here. I found relief amongst you all. I found relief in my meetings and my sponsees and my sponsor. Through this time, aside all the baggage that I carried about religion and my beliefs about that, I did develop a relationship with a power greater than myself. I have always had a belief in God, ever since I can remember. I believe where I struggle is faith. I have a hard time with that faith thing, and they are not the same. And I still struggle with that. And even when I look in hindsight at the things that I've been through, and I see how God has been there and carried me through, still, when I get faced with the next one, I want a plan. It's Connie's plan. I got to figure it all out. A lot of people call it future tripping. My first sponsor used to call it morbid projection. The big book talks about morbid reflection. That's not my thing. I'm looking into, I'm scared of what's coming, planning and organizing, forecasting, rearranging. It just, that's what I want to do. And then, things happen, and I realize that I have no control over these things, and I have no choice but to rely on God. And it works. And it gets me through those things. I was raised in a sponsorship family, and have moved into a new sponsorship family, because we moved 30 miles north, which really isn't that far, but it's like a whole different world. Got a new home group. That was a weird experience. When you grow up in one home group, I was sober for what, 10, 11 years in one home group in Richmond, and then moving 30 miles north. It's like they do AA all different there. And going to those meetings, and you people do not do it right. But it took a solid year for me to feel planted again in AA, in that new home group, in those meetings. It took a long time. It's like being a newcomer all over again, except for people don't pay any attention to you. When you're new and you ask who's in your first 30 days here and you raise your hand, people are going to swarm you. And I'm not in my first 30 days. I was 11 years sober, but brand new there. And they were like, oh, okay. And I'm busy getting all resentful because the women aren't nice and they're not talking to me. And then I realize it's me. I'm not talking to them either. Get outside yourself. And so I got a service position. I got a new sponsor. I do the things that we know we're supposed to do. Those things, they actually work. And they do work, and life is again, life is amazing. And, the 11th step talks about it. It talks about the fact that we have to continue to grow and enlarge our spiritual condition. Otherwise, we are not going to be able to face the low spots or something like that. I'm paraphrasing. And I don't need a low spot to drink, right? I drank before, whether it was sunny out, raining, cloudy, happy, sad. I don't need a low spot to drink. I'll drink for any reason. But certainly, since I've been sober, and miraculously, the obsession to drink has never returned. But I know that it could. And I'm going to continue to do these things. And the truth is, the stuff that really gets me going almost every day, it's not these big monumental things that have happened in my life. It's the little things, it's the little things. And because of that, I stay current with my sponsor. I call her. We have a scheduled call every Tuesday. I can call her in between if I need to. And sometimes I do need to, because I can get crazy about things. I love the 10th step.
I absolutely love living in that. I love the immediate gratification of making something right when I've screwed up, because I don't like that feeling of ick when I have, you know. I love that. I do try with the 11th step. It's hard. It's hard. It just what it looks like most of the time for me is sitting quietly, and just asking God to direct me. Because if I wake up in the morning and say, "Gee, God, what's, your plan for me today?" I'm already screwed, right? Because now I got Connie stamped all over it because I've created a plan and I'm going to march out of the house with my plan, which is no longer God's plan. And so I do much better if I just take it moment by moment, which is kind of like an active 10th step, right? It's just as situations present themselves, what's the right thing to do here? And if I screw up, there's a step for that. We can fix it. 12th step, I do a sponsor. I come and I do things like this, which is kind of like 12 step work, and I enjoy it. I love doing it. Life still has things going on. We have a beautiful blended family now. My husband and I have stepchildren. I have children that are married. I have grandchildren. Out of the blue, a couple years ago, this other child showed up that apparently belonged to my first husband that nobody knew about. It's this kind of stuff was not supposed to happen to me. If you saw how I grew up and what my life looks like now, but apparently the miracles of 23andMe, right? And he showed up after my ex-husband had already died. But the cool thing is that my kids want to have a relationship with him. And so he comes to Thanksgiving. It's like, it's the craziest thing. Life is good. It's been a weird couple days. I'll just, let's see what I was like, what happened, what I'm like now. Make sure I'm staying on track. It's the unanticipated things in life that really throw me. Because even the bad things, if I have a plan for it, I'm usually pretty good. Most recently, Friday night, we got out of work a little early. It was snowing up in Richmond. My boss came in and was like, "Get on the road. It's snowing already." And I was like, "Cool, Friday, get off work early." Hit the grocery store. I got all kinds of plans. I'm going to come home, make dinner, relax in front of the fire with my husband. I get in the house. We have these aging animals. We had two dogs and two cats. One of the cats was laying on the floor. I thought he was dead. He understands 12 years old, kidney disease. He was on high blood pressure medication and he was blind. But what that night turned into was driving through the snow to the urgent care vet and having to make a really difficult decision. And it was horrible. And yet I am so grateful for it because I could be completely present. I felt the feelings. I'm not afraid of my feelings now. I don't want to feel these things. I don't want to do these things. It's a sucky, awful thing to have to do. I'm crying. My husband's crying. It stinks. But it's real. It's authentic. It's life. I get to show up. I get to be useful. I get to be present. It's just experiences, and some of them are not so good, and other ones are fantastic. And you fast forward 2 days and it's Super Bowl Sunday and my kids are coming over with the grandkids. And all of a sudden I got a house full of grandkids and I see life differently. And it's remarkable to me. These two little boys that were born at 25 weeks are 5 years old now. They are completely healthy, normal 5-year-olds. And they're playing with Hot Wheels cars all over the house. And their little brother who's coming up on 1 year old, he's crawling all over the place. And my daughter is leaving them with us next Friday night, overnight. The mom who was driving all over county, drunk off her ass, she told her younger brothers, my older one, she's a smart one. She told her younger brothers, "Don't get in the car with mom." She knew. And she knows my husband's story. She knows all about us. And she sees us now. And she sees what recovery looks like. And it's authentic and it's real and it's lasting. And this is what we do to stay. And because of that, I get to experience the life that I have. So I don't know if that's enough time, but I think I'm done. I appreciate it so much. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you. We're going to pass these baskets around. As an AA group, watch being fully self-supporting, etc.
Every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. While contributions cover each group's rent and other expenses, the seventh tradition is essential at every level of AA service. It is both a privilege and a responsibility for groups and members to ensure that not only their group, but also their intergroup, central office, local services, district area, and general service office remain self-supporting. This keeps AA free of outside influences that might divert us from our primary purpose to help the alcoholic who still suffers. Our common welfare, a word about safety. Our group endeavors to provide a safe meeting place for all attendees and encourages each person here to contribute to fostering a secure and welcoming environment in which our meeting can take place. I'll take a few announcements for the good of AA. Bob, would you stand up and do it nice and loud?
There are hotels booked up at the window, but we have an alternate plan to find that out. That
I like that. I got a secret marketing. Dale.
So I've been with Jamie Boyer, they have 5th year of sobriety. We're going to have a celebration of life for her March 7th at Albert Baptist Church, 2 to 4. Bring the service to beware. Thank you.
Thank you, Dale. Is that going to end up on the intergroup website, you reckon? Any other announcements? Simple Actions is a home group. If you're interested in joining our home group or in need of a sponsor, please hang out after the meeting. Home group members, please raise your hands. Sponsorship in Alcoholics Anonymous is yours for the asking. We urge you, do not delay. If you have questions or would like additional information about sponsorship, I'll be available here, right over there, after the meeting. Please feel free to talk to me. Our group also has an email address, info@simpleactions.net. Feel free to use that if you like. Reminder, smokers, please use the butt can provided outside. Stay well away from the church doors. All meeting audio recordings and upcoming events are posted eventually on our website, simpleactions.net. We're not going to do the meeting after the meeting. Normally, if you come back next week, we'll do step one, and then we'll all go out to eat after that. Could we please thank Connie again? I especially love the morbid projections. Bob Darrow called that cleaning up the wreckage of my future. Oh, may I borrow your big book?
Yes.
Stephen, would you read the last two paragraphs on 164? Our book is meant to be suggestive only. Thank you.
Stephen, alcoholic. Lots of good stuff in the first 164, but those last two are good as well. So our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answer will come if your own house is in order. But obviously, you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then. Thank you.
Go ahead, Amy.
Next day, not February 17th. It will not be in person. It is Zoom only. If you go to our website, simpleactions.net, the Zoom link is there. It will be from 7 to 8-ish p.m. We have Trish Schroeder from New Jersey. He's an incredible circuit speaker, and he is going to speak for about an hour on spiritual principles for a lifetime, and then he will remain on the line to do a Q&A session. That's next Tuesday night, February 17th, 7 p.m. in our Zoom room.
Don't come to the church. Thank you, Amy. We probably have flyers on that event, too, over here on the table as well. And just to prepare you, if you go up to Richmond and you speak in at a Richmond meeting, the entire room will line up and come thank you after the meeting. We don't bother with that here. But I would encourage everyone to thank Connie in person after the meeting. Circle up. Oh, I want to encourage everybody. Well, thank you for your help breaking the room down. And please take the food out of here, whether you brought it or not. Get it out of here. Okay? Our Father.
Hallelujah.